A real good point, Wade. Wade points out that the Septuagint helps give more validity to the prophecies of Christ. And that goes along with what Eric is saying, is that I don't think anybody's arguing over the Septuagint. Now, they could argue about things earlier. Well, I think Daniel was written then, or I think this prophet wrote then. But the Septuagint puts it, they had to be at least 200 years before Christ. So that's pretty good. And nobody argues with the Dead Sea Scrolls where the, you know, these copies come from. It's pretty good evidence for it. Now, when you go from Justin Martyr up to St. Augustine, and St. Augustine was also, he was in the 4th century. He was a contemporary of Jerome who would translate the Latin Vulgate. And the Latin Vulgate is an important document because it was a translation of the Bible. St. Augustine was a strong proponent of the Septuagint and thought it was divinely inspired. He considered it of equal authority with the Hebrew versions of the Old Testament. He said that the Septuagint translators are justly believed to have received the spirit of prophecy, so that if they made any alterations under his authority and did not adhere to a strict translation, we could not doubt that this was divinely dictated. Therefore, we find that the apostles justly sanction the Septuagint by quoting it as well as the Hebrew when they adduce proofs from the scriptures. Okay, so he's strongly in favor of the Septuagint. And the reason we care about the Septuagint, the reason we've commented on it so far, is because the Greek Septuagint contains a number of the books not in the Hebrew Masoretic text, and that includes some of those that make up the Apocrypha. So, you know, if the Septuagint can be trusted, then some people go from that, well, what about the apocryphal books? And let's think about that. Is the Apocrypha something we can could possibly consider as a viable, as inspired writing with authority? Here's some dates to think about. In 382 A.D., that's the 4th century, and that's also when St. Augustine lived, Jerome is the one who begins his translation of the Bible into Latin, which is the Latin Vulgate. I like the way this author says it. He says, Jerome views that only Hebrew texts are authoritative, but grumpily includes the Apocrypha anyway. I had never heard grumpily used as an adverb. Grumpily. Can you picture a translator doing that? Oh, okay. Grump. Yeah. And then in this timeline, to just kind of give an overview of the Apocrypha, Martin Luther in 1534 put the Apocrypha in a separate section between the Old and New Testaments. And in 1536, Menno Simons, everybody know who Menno Simons is? No. That's where the Mennonites came from. He started as a Roman Catholic priest like Martin Luther. Somebody told him to read the Bible. He did, and he changed. And the area he changed in, he joined the Anabaptists. The Anabaptists were the ones that figured out, these babies aren't really being baptized. You know, I'm reading the scriptures, and it's not harmonizing with what we're doing here. So he changed his mind on that and became the leader of what is now the Mennonites. And I think I'm not real familiar with the Mennonite doctrines or things like that, but I think they still kind of like him, and we'll talk about it. But anyway, he accepted the Apocrypha as a part of the canon. 1546, the Roman Catholic Council of Trent approves the inclusion of the Apocrypha in the canon. 1611, the King James translators put the Apocrypha in a section in their translation. But in 1629, when they revise it again, the Apocrypha is left out. And it's been left out ever since from the King James Version. 1646, the Westminster Confession, which is the creed of the Presbyterians. I can't remember. Does anybody recall right offhand? Anyway, it's the creed of one of those large denominations. They place the Apocrypha on the same level as other human writings. Westminster Confession. I'm thinking Presbyterian. Okay, so Presbyterian is... Okay. All right. Anyway, they were one of the denominations that placed it on the level of human writings. 1827, British and American Bible societies decide to omit the Apocrypha from their Bible editions. So it just doesn't get much traction. Where it's really got traction, most of all, I think, is in the Roman Catholic Church. And why, I'm not sure, but they do like it quite a bit. This great debate over whether or not it should be viewed as authoritative has been going on for 2,000 years. In the early years of the church, it was natural for Christians to use the Septuagint translation of the Bible, as this was the language most familiar to them. As such, many of the early church fathers quoted from the Apocrypha in the same way that they quoted from the New and Old Testaments. However, there was some discord even as early as the 4th century. So you see, the early church fathers are quoting from it, but the apostles is what we use to decide the canon on. Did the apostles quote from the Apocrypha? And the answer is they didn't. So we went by what they quoted from. The Roman Catholic Church, of course, will use the argument, they kind of reverse that argument, like, well, there's a lot of Old Testament books they didn't quote from. How come they're included? Yeah. So they'll use that argument. So if you could include the Song of Solomon in the canon, why can't you include the Apocrypha? That's kind of the way they go on that one. So... I don't remember the other books they listed. There are a few others that were not. I think the counter to that was when they decided the canon, they looked at books that harmonized with each other. For example, the Chronicles and Kings and Samuel, they all harmonize with each other. So whether or not any New Testament writer quoted from Chronicles, it's still harmonizing with everything else. I think that's the best counter argument that there is. I don't know if there's any other or not. But I don't know if there's any particular doctrines. There may be a way to, maybe an easy way to find that out. But there may be some doctrines that they use the Apocrypha to justify. I don't know. That's good. A good point, Lewis. The fact that the Old Testament writers, the original text, the Masoretic text, you know, kept it at the number of books they had, is a good counter argument to accepting the Apocrypha as inspired. And that's good. You know, there's things you can be pretty sure about, and there's other things that are just, I'm not sure about that. Sounds kind of right. That's good. That is good. That's what I read too, is that he got pressure from others. Not sure who. Could have been an Augustine among them. But he got pressure to include it, and that's why he grudgingly put it in. But he was not convinced. So that's a good point. Now, and this may be what I'm thinking of right here. In 382 A.D., when Jerome was asked by Pope, and that's odd because I don't think he was called Pope at that time. The best he could have been was the Bishop of Rome, I think, at this time. But anyway, he was asked by a great leader in the church to translate the Bible into Latin. Jerome felt that only Hebrew texts were authoritative, like Lewis said. He therefore rejected the Greek additions to the Septuagint, but under pressure still included them in the Vulgate, calling them apocryphal, meaning hidden writings. That cryphal in there is similar to the word crypt. And what's a crypt? Where you hide the body, where you cover up the body. The apocryphal books, these are covered up. On the other end of this spectrum, Jerome's contemporaries, Augustine, strongly believed in the canonicity of the Greek additions to the Septuagint. He considered the Septuagint translation to be divinely inspired. St. Athanasius, who lived in the 4th century as well, his list of the books of the New Testament would become the standard of the Christian world, took a middle view, stating in his 367 A.D. Paschal letter that there are other books besides those not indeed included in the canon, but appointed by the fathers to be read by those who newly join us and who wish for instruction in the word of godliness. The wisdom of Solomon, the wisdom of Sirach, and Esther and Judith and Tobit, and that which is called the teaching of the apostles and the shepherd. So at that time, apparently, they were recommending the apocryphal books to be read by new converts. Why, I'm still not sure. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It wouldn't be called the Apocrypha. Yeah, I don't think they include that in the Apocrypha. I don't know if they have I'm not sure if they have the Didache in their copies of their Bible, but they definitely have the Apocrypha, and I don't think they have that whole list. I'm not sure if they have the whole list. I forgot their number, but I know. It's not consistent. There's variations in the way they look at it, and again, I'm not sure what their point is in including them, unless they just like the way they sound or something. I don't know. But it's a good point. Orthodox Church, which generally uses the Septuagint as its primary translation, Greek Orthodox Church, also accepts the Apocrypha as canonical, and adds other books not included in the Vulgate, such as 1 Esdras 3, 3rd and 4th Maccabees, and Psalm 151. Now, the most heated debates regarding the authoritativeness of the Apocrypha began in the Reformation. Martin Luther, in 1534, placed the books of the Apocrypha in a separate section between the Old and New Testaments, and he commented, "Apocrypha, that is, books which are not held equal to the sacred scriptures, and nevertheless are useful and good to read." Somebody else said at one time, if they're not inspired, they are inspiring. And that may be why they keep them. That's maybe why the Roman Catholic Church keeps them in there, is they think they're inspirational. To me, that reminds me of what people say about the Old Testament. There's a lot of people that say the Old Testament is just a bunch of stories written to inspire the Jews. And that always leaves me flat. Just leaves me cold. It's like, oh, so you make up a story to inspire people. I mean, I'm inspired knowing that it really happened, not that it was something that somebody made up. Let's make up a story that will inspire everybody. Truth is inspiring. And to know that these stories really took place is inspiring to me. So I guess you might say he's kind of recommending it as good literature. These are good. They're safe to read. They're nice stories. But we need more than that for them to be considered something we should follow. So I'm glad you looked that up, Eric. The Westminster Confession has the elements of or is somehow connected to the Calvinist's way of thinking. The Calvinist argument is one of the strongest argument against the apocrypha being authoritative. And here are some of the points they usually make. First of all, the books of the Apocrypha are not a part of the Jewish canon, which is what Lewis was saying. They're not a part of the Masoretic text. Second, while 90% of the New Testament references to the Old Testament are from the Septuagint, there are no New Testament references to the Apocrypha. And we talked about that a little bit ago. Next, Jerome rejected the apocryphal books. They use that as a point in their favor, giving Jerome some credence. There are geographical and historical errors in some of the apocryphal books. In Judith, for example, who says that Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Assyria. The counter-argument to that is, it's more like a parable, and everything doesn't have to be accurate. Well, in the parables of Christ, things were accurate. They were, as we talked about before, they were based on things that actually happened, even though that story itself may not have taken place. That you get the historical things right. So none of the authors of the Apocrypha claim divine inspiration. Again, Judith is used as an example of why we don't want to accept the Apocrypha is because lying and assassination are accepted as tools for good in the book of Jude. So we've heard the arguments from both sides, and it continues on to this day. Brother Eldon. Oh, okay, Wade, go ahead. Yeah, and in what you read was the Palestinian text, the Masoretic text. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, it was maybe the Palestinian text. Yeah, got it. Yeah, that's good. But like I said, don't let any of these things discourage you. These are the obstacles in the way to get to the truth. So don't let them discourage you. Always look for the spirit of the law and look for how the books harmonize with each other. And I think you'll be on solid ground. Does anyone have any other comments or questions on what we've talked about so far? And we'll spend the rest of our time with the book reviews. Tag, go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Good distinction. Yeah, Tad points out that in the Old Testament there are other books mentioned that they're not in the canon, so they had value, but not necessarily inspired. And a good example of what Tad's talking about is yesterday we used First Maccabees to describe the Maccabean Revolt. It's good history. That at least is good history, and it was very helpful. But yet, as far as using that as doctrine or anything like that, we're not going to get into that. Just look at that as a historical source. Okay. All the books you've ever wanted to know about here. We're going to start with Tobit. Tobit is an interesting story. It talks about a very religious, God-fearing Jew who lives in Nineveh during the Assyrian occupation of northern Israel in the 7th century before Christ. As a result of committing a very good deed, a pious act, He buried a Jew who had been strangled in the marketplace. Tobit goes blind. So it's his suffering for doing something good. He goes blind. And he isn't the only one who's got problems. There's a woman named Sarah who's possessed by a demon named Asmodeus, or Asmodeus. And Asmodeus, Sarah is married 7 times, and as soon as she married a husband, Asmodeus would kill the husband. That's why she was married 7 times. I guess she thought each new husband it wouldn't happen again, but every time she got married, the evil spirit would kill her husband. So she's been married 7 times. And, I don't know if that's where Herman's Hermit's got that song. I don't know. Anyway, there were prayers of supplication from Sarah and Tobit, and it speaks of the angel Raphael. And that's a little bit of a problem, because we don't know in the Old Testament or the New Testament that there was an angel Raphael. But in the Apocrypha, they talk about Raphael and I think 1 or 2 other angels by name. So that's a little problem there for me. Raphael the angel is sent to heal both Sarah and Tobit. And the son of Tobit teams up with the angel Raphael. And they team up, and in the process of this, their teamwork, the son of Tobit marries Sarah, casts out the demon Asmodeus, and the way he cast out the demon was he used a foul-smelling concoction made of fish liver and heart. It was recommended by the angel Raphael. And with the same concoction that cast out the demon, he's able to heal his father of blindness. Okay. Now, God does work in mysterious ways, but this is kind of more than mysterious, I think. Now, as a result of this, Tobit lives to the ripe old age of 112, and his son lives to be 117. There are some humorous things in this, not like we haven't already seen some humorous things, but the smell of the fish concoction is said to have driven the demon to the remotest parts of Egypt. So it was very effective. There is and there's also a scene in the book of Tobit where Sarah's father, Raguel, tells his servants to dig a grave for the young son of Tobit, Tobias, on the night of his wedding because of the possibility that he may be killed by the demon before the morning. When a maid discovers that Tobias is quite alive, Raguel has the grave filled in before the sun rises. So hopefully nobody knew that we dug a grave for him, thinking he's not going to last. The other 7 husbands didn't last. I don't think he's going to last either, but they didn't apparently realized that he'd already cast out the demons. Oh. So how is this relevant to Christianity? Well, it does show how much Jews were interested in angels and demons. That's one thing it does. I don't know how helpful that is to us, but they were definitely interested in it. Now, as far as the angel Raphael, we may view that he is an archangel, but yet when you look in the New Testament and the whole Bible, there's only one person spoken of as an archangel. So I think you can only have one archangel. So I don't know if they don't know what archangel means. I don't know. There could be a hierarchy in heaven. That's very possible. As far as archangel, we only know it would apply to one of the angels. Lewis, were you going to say something? Ted? Yeah. On our chart, let's refer to our chart here again. Tobit was written 200 BC. So written after, if you assume that it actually took place, which I don't assume that, but if for the sake of the discussion, it was written about 500 years after it took place. Yeah, on that list, you remember it's considered a religious novel, as is Jude. Those two are considered religious novels. Any other comments on Tobit? You ready to go out and buy a copy? Or just read it online for free? Okay. One more thing on Tobit. They say that one of its redeeming qualities is that they like the prayer that's spoken by Tobias during his wedding ceremony. And they say the Amish use these in their ceremonies today. So she got up, and they began to pray and implore that they might be kept safe. Tobias began by saying, "Blessed are you, O God of our ancestors, and blessed is your name in all generations forever. Let the heavens and the whole creation bless you forever. You made Adam, and for him you made his wife Eve as a helper and support. From the two of them the human race has sprung. You said, 'It is not good that the man should be alone. Let us make a helper for him like himself.' I now am taking this kinswoman of mine, not because of lust, but with sincerity. Grant that she and I may find mercy and that we may grow old together." And they both said, "Amen, amen." So that's kind of nice. Nice. You guys can use that at your wedding, I guess. Yeah.